You're listening to Policy Speaking. I'm your host, Edward Greenspan, President and CEO of the Public Policy Forum. Thanks for tuning in. And today, we will be bringing you inside the new Senate of Canada, the Independent Senate of Canada, and 12 of the senators, calling themselves the Senate Prosperity Action Group, has just released a report on the future of Canada's economy, where we should be going in a post-pandemic world to ensure that there is a strong economy for all. And we've done a public event at the Public Policy Forum with the Senate. And as I say, we'll be bringing you to a discussion of that soon. But first, today, we want to start with a discussion with the editor of PPF Media, Katie Davey.
Hi, Ed. It's great to be back and start doing these conversations with you again. You know, we've been on a bit of a hiatus. So one of the things we've decided to do, as you know, is kind of give this section of the podcast a bit of a name. So we actually have a formal segment. So it will now be called Today in Policy, because that's what we always talk about. We talk about what's going on, you know, kind of current affairs, public policy, and everything that we're focused on. So that's our official name that we'll kick off each episode with. But to your point, this Senate report actually is, you know, today in policy. I know for me, it got lots of buzz. I was seeing it on social media. I was seeing it, well, I guess not seeing, hearing it in conversations that I was having. Let's start there and actually unpack the report a bit before we head over to your interview. So give me a bit of a summary of this report. What is it and why is it important?
Well, the report called Rising to the Challenges of New Global Realities was maybe the new Senate at its best. At one point in the introduction in the Senate chambers, when there were two panels about the report that we'll be listening to one of the panels today that I moderated, you know, I made the point that Sir John A. Macdonald thought of the Senate as the chamber of sober second thought. But what these senators have done is they've said, look, let's get ahead of a second thought, and let's have some sober first thought. And the sober first thought is both what can be done to make the economy work better for everyone, and how do we do it? Because there's a lot of discussion about what, and that discussion, a lot of the items in that discussion, like interprovincial trade barriers, let's say year after year, decade after decade, those issues are there. So how do we get there? And I think that's one of the things that also differentiates this report.
Yeah, you don't have to tell me that interprovincial trade barriers is a topic of much contention. As you'll know, a big part of that is the border between New Brunswick and Quebec. So indeed, a lot of the issues that are outlined in this report.
Can I just sort of, did you sneak in a New Brunswick reference right there?
I did, yes. I mean,
Okay, so we are back at normal. Good to be back in business.
That's right. I mean, I can't let you down, Ed. So, yeah, but as you say, a lot of the issues that are highlighted in the report are not necessarily new issues, but they kind of are collated into this one grouping with a number of recommendations. But to your point, a big piece of what is often missing in this conversation is the now what, right, and the how. So it was nice for me, too, to see that in this report. Two things really stuck out to me as well. One is this call for the Prosperity Council, which really is this collaborative, multi-party, multi-jurisdiction, multi-stakeholder group that would support, you know, in some ways, the enactment of things in this report and a growth agenda more broadly. And then again, as you say, the metrics, like what is success and setting those out and agreeing on them from the start. I think that's a really important piece that stuck out to me.
The idea of this Prosperity Council was that there's no single body in Canada that can make policy and complex policies. You know, think about the energy transition as one set of policy. Well, you got to have the federal government, you got to have the provincial government, you got to have municipalities, you have to have First Nations governments, you have to have the private sector, you have to have labor unions, you have to have civil society. There's all kinds of interests that need to get themselves aligned and need to build a consensus. It's not easy to build a consensus, but if you try to go around, you know, you're certain of failure. And I think that's a message that here. So they talk about a grand alliance in this report on the Prosperity Council. And, you know, the two guests that I'll be talking to in the next portion of this, and that I spoke to already in the Senate chamber, the Right Honorable Joe Clark and the Honorable Christy Clark. Joe Clark, of course, was Prime Minister of Canada and was a Foreign Minister of Canada and was also in charge of the constitutional areas and trying to draw a plan for Canada together in the Charlottetown Accord, and Christy Clark, the former Premier of British Columbia. And they, as I say, are trying to talk in this session about the how. On the what, there's a lot of people discussing the what, including, you know, the Public Policy Forum and many of our reports and our Rebuild Canada work last year and many of the other reports that we're doing now on an export strategy for Canada, on digital infrastructure, the next stage and generation in digital infrastructure for Canada, making sure that it's accessible to all and it's like world leading. Those are both important aspects of that. And the Business Council of Canada and a whole coalition of groups are together in an initiative that's chaired, co-chaired by Lisa Raitt, the former Conservative minister, and Anne McClellan, the former Liberal deputy prime minister. And it's got an advisory council of about a dozen people. And, you know, again, the Public Policy Forum is lined up with that effort, and it's going to get a big push up the hill, one hopes, at a conference in late October in Ottawa, a hybrid conference that people can join either live or virtually. A lot of work in a lot of places, and all of this has to be drawn together to work with governments to adopt policies that will assure that we have, you know, the clean, sustainable, digital, active, robust, resilient economy of the future. All of those things are going to be required. And without growth at the base of it, it's hard to have fairness without growth.
So what you're telling me is the shuffled cabinet we're going to hear about next week has a tall order. The list you listed off there, I think, will hopefully in some ways find its way to the priority of the federal government, as you say, and in some ways we'll see what the federal government decides its priorities are based on how the cabinet shuffle goes on the 26th, I guess it is.
Yeah, no, I think the cabinet will have a tall order. I mean, the government, the incumbent government, was reelected again with a minority, but a fairly strong minority. And it has certain items on its agenda that it's quite clear about and that are economically minded as well as being socially minded. I'm particularly thinking of childcare, which is an area of great interest, I know, to you personally. And you've written, you know, written on it, and PPF, you've written for PPF on it. So it has an agenda, but on top of that, the pandemic leaves us needing to think about, okay, what is long-term growth going to look like? We're at a turning point in the history of the country, I think, because of the pandemic, because of climate change, because of the digital technological breakthroughs that we're seeing, because of geopolitical change. There's a lot of forces that are conspiring to make us have to revisit our assumptions about the economy. And we've got to make sure that we, you know, don't throw out the baby with the bathwater. And, you know, we keep what's good and work and make it fit with the new realities that we have. And so I think that will be a big challenge for the new government.
It's interesting you say that because, you know, really this word transformation and transition really showed up in the Senate report, but also obviously there's linkages to this big, massive global conversation, well, a number of global conversations, but of course one that'll be kicking off again in a few weeks, which is COP26, talking about climate, energy, transition, all of these pieces. So what are you looking towards as we head into COP26? I guess it kicks off on Halloween, so on October 31st.
You know, the COP26, for people who don't follow this intimately, is, you know, the 26th time that world leaders are getting together, you know, to talk about where we are going with climate in the world. And they've been doing this for many years, ever since the Rio Summit and Earth Summit in 1992 and a sort of, you know, big moment in Kyoto in 1997, I believe it was. Of course, the Paris Agreement 5-6 years ago. So this is the COP26. They missed one last year. And people have been doubling down on their, what they call, you know, the ambition for climate reductions. We've seen a lot of work coming into this COP from various places saying the situation hasn't turned around enough, hasn't been improved enough. A lot more attention, I think, to technology and innovation to resolve many of the challenges that we have. But I think Canada has some particular issues that it cares about and needs to care about as an exporting country, and particularly as an exporter of resources to the world. So, you know, Canada, it's an amazing number, but, you know, in a report that we have coming out over the next week or so before the COP, 45% of the Canadian footprint of carbon footprint is leaves the country in the form of exports. And of course, we import 32% of our carbon from other countries, but in net, we export a lot more carbon. So because the carbon is counted against the producer and not the producing nation, the consuming nation, this counts against Canada. And the question for Canada is, how can we make ourselves into a low carbon, into a net zero exporter, starting low carbon, moving towards net zero, so that we have advantage in the world where there'll be carbon border adjustments and other aspects? And should we and can we somehow or another get credit for that if we're subsidizing the carbon that's been consumed in other countries? And these are very difficult questions with winners and losers, but you know, Canada has a national interest there, and you can't be on the side against the global commons. You must be for the global commons. So you have to be exporting things that are lower carbon than would otherwise be out there in the marketplace. So I think those are really fascinating questions. And part, you know, just to tie it back together, of course, you know, part of the agenda of how you build an economy of the future.
Oh, absolutely. And the good news is that's the exact topic of our podcast, our next podcast. So we'll be talking about the low carbon export strategy, among other pieces, with Jean Charest. And of course, Ed, you'll be leading that. So with that, I think it wraps up policy or today in policy. I was going to say policy today. We'll workshop it, but today in policy. So Ed, over to you for your interview.
Well, I'm just, I'll say very quickly, pleased to share the conversation I had with the Right Honorable Joe Clark, former Prime Minister of Canada, the Honourable Christy Clark, former Premier of British Columbia. I hope you all enjoy it.
I'm thrilled to have the opportunity to discuss the work that you've done, and particularly the context in which it lands with two of our nation's most prominent political clerks. The Right Honourable Joe Clark, Canada's 16th Prime Minister, and Christy Clark, the 35th Premier of British Columbia. And we are going to start with a chat among ourselves, and then we'd like to open it up to you as well. There's a couple of interveners. We expect to pose very tough questions. I don't think that there's any questions after years in politics that that can bamboozle you in any way. So, but they're going to test the proposition nonetheless. We will see. So before we start, maybe I will, I just want to clarify for everybody, there is no relation, right? No relationship.
No, not that I know.
I mean, maybe 17 generations back or something of that sort.
There's a lot of Clarks.
Yeah, that's right.
Aren't there?
There are.
Yeah, even as BC premiers, in fact. So, okay, look, let's start out with the fact that you both have held elected office. You've both been in cabinets, you've both led governments, and you've had to find a way to make policies acceptable to publics. So, Mr. Clark, let's start with you. How difficult is it, do you think, in these days to forge the kind of political consensus that will be necessary for the sort of document that we're seeing here and the sort of vision we're seeing?
I think consensus is much more difficult now than it was. I think that there was a sense, even among partisans, at least in the National Parliament, I can't speak for the legislature of BC, to at the end of the day, by and large, come to agreement. And I think that is less the case now. And it's a major fault for a country like ours, because we are not simply a federation, we're a diverse federation, not fragile, in my view, but not as strong as we like to believe we are. And when there was a sense of cooperation within legislatures or parliaments, not all the time, obviously, it was often rare, but a capacity to come to agreement on things, I think that had an effect upon the general public atmosphere of seeking to agree. So In that context, if I may, I think that this report is a very helpful step forward. And I hope it can, I think it was framed in that spirit, and I hope that it can be pursued in that spirit generally. But we need more examples of this, because if one tries to trace times when institutional strength goes up and it goes down, we are on a downward curve now at a very dangerous time for a country like ours or any country to be at a downward curve.
Is that a cyclical curve, do you think, or is that a more fundamental downward slope?
I worry it isn't cyclical because, and remember, I come from a certain era and a certain background. I came from a time when national parties meant something. And it could be said of all the national parties of my era that they were broadly representative of the country. I've said before that I learned more about my country in a national political party than I did anywhere else. Now the parties are less inclusive than they need to be. And to a remarkable degree, they seem to be interested in being less inclusive than they need to be. What that meant, that experience in the cabinets of which I was part, is that the great majority of people who went into cabinet had direct personal experience with others who came from elsewhere, came quite deeply from elsewhere, but had learned to get along. We had become a family of difference. That was quite significant when we came down to actually looking at public policy and how, wherever it emerged, it might be modified or applied across a diverse country and into a wider world. I'm not sure that's the case now. I also have to say, and I don't mean to sound too old-fashioned, that caucuses mattered more in those days than they do now. A leader has always had authority. Sometimes the authority of a leader is less than others, but nonetheless, a leader has always had authority. But I think now the leader's authority and the authority of the entourage of the leaders is more dominant than it has been or than it should be. And I think that's that's another barrier we have to crack, in my view.
Christy, I want you to go down the same road for a minute, if you will. Is the system by which we have found agreement on tough issues or routes to follow, is it broken? Is there even a system anymore?
Well, I think leadership matters a lot in this country, and I mean in every country. And I think the habit that we've gotten into in our federation, where prime minister beats up on the premiers and the premiers beat up on the prime minister, has done, I mean, we don't talk about that as polarization, but that is really what's happened. And as long as each sees each other as a convenient punching bag, I don't think we're going to get much consensus in the country. And we don't have much leadership then either, because this was the thing that I liked about the report the best, although there's lots of great things in it, is this idea that we need an institution or we need a method to bring the provinces and the federal government together, because the provinces have unique jurisdiction. And Prime Minister Clark, Prime Minister Cretchen, Prime Minister Mulroney, Prime Minister Martin all really understood that division of powers and respected it and understood that in order to make Canada work, you gotta work together. And there was lots of compromise back in those days. And so I think the proposal in the report that suggests that there could be a prosperity group that would come together, set measurements, bring, is really, really important to bring people together. But ultimately, if people don't want to get along, if people are spoiling for a fight, which is what we saw over the carbon tax, which was, I thought, a terrible mess for Canada, could have been a tremendous accomplishment. Instead, it's mostly failed across the country. If we can find a way to get along, because leaders decide they choose to get along, like you would in any marriage, then we will have a better country. And I think we need to, Canadians would be wise to think about the character of the leaders they are electing and what they're going to bring to that conversation if we want to keep Canada together.
Well, I want to come back to the Federation and the Prosperity Council idea in a few moments for sure. Let's just stick with the idea of the forces that sort of seem to pull people more apart now. And indeed, whether the pandemic pulls us together, pulls us apart in some ways. Now, certainly the Senate report sees the pandemic as a pivotal moment, almost a Second World War opportunity kind of moment to redefine where we're going. Let me start with you and then I'll go to Joe Clark. Are we at some kind of pivotal moment that presents an opportunity to redefine the course we're on?
I've heard, you know, people talk about this as kind of a World War II, post-World War II experience. In World War II, we had leaders that people looked to, leaders that were having tough conversations with Canadians and leaders around the world who were doing the same with their citizenry. We had a national, we had national unity around it. We had governments that worked together, and we really had an overwhelming sense of purpose. I mean, what do we have now? We have protests. We have political parties that have grown out of the pandemic that are taking huge swaths of the vote or huge swaths of numbers and vote across the country. We have leaders who are fighting with one another, practically at fisticuffs. And we have protests happening here. I mean, I would argue this is not post-World War II. This is more like post-Vietnam. We just have these deep, deep social divisions that have been deepened, exposed, and then I think further deepened by the pandemic. And that in itself presents a new problem. Rather than kind of a healing moment, I think we're actually at probably a more fragile moment than we've been for a long time.
Okay, fair enough. So force of division. There are some forces, presumably, of solidarity too. But where would you come down on that?
I think we're fragile. I think we're all fragile. COVID was a shock to everyone. And as the earlier discussions indicated, it was a greater shock to some than to others, but it was a shock to all of us. And we're not out of it. And living with that kind of uncertainty creates a sense of fragility. It may also create a greater disposition to examine ourselves, to say, okay, things we didn't expect to happen, happened. More things we don't expect are likely to happen. How do we deal with this? I think that there are some people whose bruising we underestimate. And again, I think they tend to be people who are less prepared financially or for other reasons to deal with this and don't have a lot of help in dealing with it. But I think collectively, we are in a position where we have to say, okay, what I thought worked, didn't pay much attention to it, but I thought it was working, doesn't. What else doesn't work? And what should we be doing to identify the changes that we can make? So I think there is a, you know, when things are going well, it's fairly easy to identify a common sense of opportunity. It may well be that when things are going badly, there can also be that response to a common opportunity. What is important is common. We have to do it together. I had some successes in public life, and I had some flamboyant lacks of success. And one of them, by some reading, was that a constitutional accord that I chaired was roundly and enthusiastically rejected by most of the people of the country. And that's become its signature. But what it really did was get the Federation together, mm-hmm. all the premiers, all the heads of government of the territories, four highly respected and representative leaders of the Indigenous community in the country, and we came at the end of the day to a unanimous agreement on a range of very substantial changes and issues in the country. Now, I'm not disputing the electoral decision. It was on other occasions in partisan ways. I have disputed it, but I'm not doing that now. What I'm saying is that there was an example there. And part of it was that we, first of all, recognized what we had done wrong before. In our earlier attempts at constitutional change, we had left out critical groups. One of them had an eagle feather, which he waved in the legislature of Manitoba and brought down the process, and probably should have. So we went out deliberately to try to be much more inclusive, both in the agenda and in the style than we were. And as I say, sitting around those interminable discussions, and you've been through interminable discussions, we actually got very real agreement from people whom you would not think would agree. This is not out of school. I can say that one of the most difficult people to persuade was the then Premier of Newfoundland, Clyde Wells, a person who was absolutely critical at the end of the day in persuading him was the Premier of Alberta, Don Getty, who, using powers he must have learned in a football huddle, was able to go down and persuade Clyde Wells to move a little bit. But the point is that when we were together, when we overcame the sense that we were representing different poles, when we thought we had a common interest, then we found a way to agree. What do I learn from that? I think that there can be replicas of that idea. I agree absolutely with Christie's view that there has to be much more cooperation among the formal leaders of our federation. But I also think it can occur. You've seen it occur.
Yeah.
And I think that there has to be much, I think we've got to be much less insular than we have been in the past and begin to be inclusive in the discussion of public debate. And you need things to talk about where consensus can be gathered. And there are at least some elements of the report that we're dealing with today that can fill that bill, not least because they are addressing, as governments have to, questions of real current urgency in the world. And I don't fault professional public services. I don't fault anyone else who has a job to do. What I do believe is that if we are focusing narrowly on our responsibility, we're probably missing something. All of us need outside advice and perspectives and encouragement. And I think that these kinds of reports on the one hand, but also the kind of broad discussion that we were able to engender during the Charlottetown process can cause people who would not otherwise agree come to say, I've got more in common here than I thought. And that's worth doing.
Let me ask you a case study as well that you were involved with, obviously, with Premier, which is around energy. And energy in a couple of different ways, certainly. Alberta's energy coming through BC, which was a very difficult proposition and a lot of noise around it. And, of course, your own LNG, desire for LNG development, which also had a lot of noise around. How did you cope with both of those in trying to forge a consensus? And do you feel that you did it?
So can I just diverge, just start by saying one of the best things that's happened as a result of the pandemic being coming to its conclusion is that energy prices are going back up again, which is great for Canada because we are an energy superpower, or we want to be, and it's going to mean much more investment in the oil sands and gas and across the country, which will mean more money for healthcare. So I feel like I've been really the opposite of Pollyanna-ish so far, sitting beside Prime Minister Clark, feeling a little negative. So I mean, I do think that's something really positive that came out of it. And we landed a $40 billion private sector investment with LNG. We got it past the point of no return before the new government could come in and cancel it. And they did, however, cancel or cause to be canceled all of the other proposals that were in the pipeline. Nonetheless, that project's going ahead. And we also, you know, set out the five conditions to enable Alberta oil to move through British Columbia. That's been kind of slowly but surely moving forward. It was really, really hard. I mean, it's so easy to just say, this is not in my electoral interest, so therefore I'm not going to do it. The much wiser thing, I think, to do, I mean, and why would you get into politics unless you were going to try and do things, is to say, okay, this is going to be hard. Everybody hates it right now, but I bet I can get enough people to like it. If I'm persuasive enough, if I'm smart enough in figuring out how to accommodate people, we can get there. Now, the thing that I learned about LNG in particular was there's two things. First, that the outcome we got to, just in terms of how we structured it, like everything from the royalties to the Indigenous agreements to the training regime that we put in place, gave us a totally different result than we expected. Like, we still ended up with a $40 billion investment, but the actual agreements that we got were way better than I thought that they would ever be. And in fact, I didn't even really think about that at the very beginning. So that's one thing. It was the product of a lot of compromise, a lot of listening, and it gave us a product that we could sell. The second thing was that I learned from this is that it's so vital to reconciliation with First Nations people to do resource development. Because what I heard when we did 40 different agreements around across the line from the Alberta border to the BC coast, and what we heard from those Indigenous people was, you white people have come into our land and for over 150 years have told us we can't use our land. That you get to use it, you get to take the benefits, and you get to go spend them down in Vancouver or Toronto or wherever your investment goes. And the only resource that many of these communities have left to get is a new piece of pie, which is oil and gas. And so I would argue that the most important learning I got from it was the way to reconciliation is we do need to apologize, we do need to reconcile, we do need to learn. But unless First Nations have the means to guarantee economic success and a way to get out of poverty, they will not succeed. And the primary means for them to get there in Canada is through resource development. So we have to get our heads around deciding to say, we are going to develop resources in Canada because that's going to do so much to help eliminate poverty in First Nations communities. And without eliminating poverty, we will never have reconciliation. And that was the most important lesson I learned.
Well, Tabitha Bull spoke a few minutes ago about Indigenous equity ownership. And she cited particularly the Clearwater deal. And PPF did a session with the main seller, John Risley, and the main buyer, Chief Terry Paul, last February. And Terry Paul said they had to go in 50-50 with the BC company, Premium Brands. They wanted to own it 100% themselves, but they couldn't get the financing for 100%. So they had to go 50-50. And they said to Premium, are you a long-term investor? And Premium said, yes, we are. And they said, well, what's long-term? And they said, Premium said, 30 years. And Terry Paul said, that's great. Fabulous. Because for us, long-term is forever. And in 30 years, we're going to buy out your 50%.
Right on. Yeah.
And I thought that's a wonderful ambition. When you talk about LNG, the Haisla are building the Cedar LNG plant, which people in this part of Canada don't know about, but in your part of Canada, I think do. At least they're, you know, moving to feasibility on that plant. So I think that's an important part of the vision, obviously.
I was sitting with the guys from Petronas in Malaysia and some First Nations folks from British Columbia. And the Malaysian guy's talking on and on about how he understands colonialism because the Brits were there and they finally got the rights to their gas back and all that stuff. And this guy said, yeah, you know, and we're really happy. I think he was a Lac Qui Lam's guy. We're really happy that you're investing here with us in our resource because just like you got it back from the British, we're going to get it back from you, pal. And that's how the world should be working, is we should be returning those resources. And, you know, when we develop those resources, that money's going to stay in communities, and it's not going to leave Canada. It's going to be spent in communities, particularly small towns across the country.
Okay, but when is a very optimistic word as opposed to if, and I appreciate your optimism. So I want to go back to maybe Charlottetown, because Charlottetown was a group of elites who agreed to something, and then a public that was angry, perhaps for economic reasons, perhaps for constitutional reasons.
A public and a very prominent former prime minister who was very angry.
Absolutely. Angry. But the point I want to make is I want to compare it in some ways to today, because it's kind of curious to me, after so many years of stagnant growth and living wages for people, that they're not angrier, that they're not actually, or at least maybe their anger is inchoate. They're not demanding more of politicians for the kind of growth agenda, prosperity agenda. Why is that?
I think they're not accustomed to turning to politicians for positive action. It happens occasionally, but I don't think it happens enough. Much more often, frequently, somebody goes and knocks on the door and feels that they're not being heard. So what does that mean? That happens everywhere. I was talking to someone much more worldly than I am the other day, and I said, all right, name a successful government in the world. And he said, Singapore. And I said, okay, name a second one. And he was stumped. But the point is, this is a very, very difficult time in the world. Lots of countries have challenges. We've got to find some way to cause Canadians to become aware of just how fortunate we are if we begin to work at it. And part of what you have found in dealing with Indigenous people is that when you give them some hope, many of them, their leaders, will respond to it and make the most of it. But if they feel they are excluded, they're going to act like they're excluded. And our capacity as a country, compared to all, we really are one of the most fortunate. Everyone says this, but it has never been more true, because we've always said it in the shadow of the United States. We're one of the most successful countries in the world. Well, by almost every standard, we're a more successful country than they are now. We're a more durable country, and we're a more durable country than most are. How do we cause people who sort of know that in their bones, how do we cause people to understand that? I think the issue is to engage them as much as we can on very specific matters and as broadly as we can. And I want to come back to I'm sorry to go back to Charlottetown, except it was obviously is on my mind. When we were starting, the popularity of the Mulroney government was as close to the basement as you could possibly be. And I realized that we were going to have a lot of trouble with a skeptical public. And I went to five public policy groups in the country, yours one of them, and asked them to co-sponsor a series of public debates. The Canada West Foundation said, sure, we'll help you if 50% of the participants in the discussions are, quote, ordinary Canadians. And I said, I can't do 50, but I can do 25%. And we set up a process. It was run by the late Arthur Kruger, an eminently respected public servant, who at one time when I as the mere minister, tried to intrude on his authority, said, sir, this is my responsibility, not yours. And we all understood that. Anyway, Arthur was in charge, and we invited people to write in. Do you think you know as much as Joe Clark does about the Constitution? There were swarms of people who were in that category and wrote in and applied. And we went through meticulously and had a selected. And in the actual discussions, time after time, the Canadian Labour Congress and the Chamber of Commerce would make their usual positions, and some ordinary Canadian, there with the same authority they had, would intervene and say, well, that's very interesting, I disagree. And anyway, that process of genuine involvement of people who are serious, who are not there just to talk, are there to help solve an issue. And all of us know, sometimes to our sorrow, that there are a lot of variants to public participation now in discussion. There's also a lot of chatter, and chatter is of almost no use in getting to solutions. But if you can get people in a context where they feel they are equal, they feel they are being heard, then I think that they are going to recognize how fortunate they are to live in this country, take a hard look at what can be done, and act on it. So I think that part of what's happening is that our accepted processes of governing are not working anywhere near as well as we expect them to be. And we don't need to throw them out, but we do have to open them up so that there can be more participation by more serious people to find more serious people to come to decisions.
So I'm just going to ask a couple more questions and I'm going to try to, and then I'm going to open it up. But do you think perhaps one of the problems we have in building consensus, engaging the public, and perhaps getting them to put pressure on is that we're just to have a very exclusive vocabulary? So we talk about prosperity, we talk about productivity, mm-hmm. we talk about growth. Funny, when daycare becomes an economic issue of growth, people, it seems, can relate to that. So do we just need to also rethink how we talk about this?
I think, yes. I think that's spot on. Daycare, housing, access to housing. I do think, though, that we have a generation, a couple of generations who've grown up in abundance. Real, mm-hmm. real true. Like the most abundant society ever in the history of human settlement is now. I think it's come to an end. I don't think people have quite caught up with that yet. We're either going to have to, we're either going to get onto this conversation quickly, or we're going to find ourselves in a very, very difficult situation. So that's, again, why I think this report is so timely. But I think there are a couple of good things on the horizon. One is Gen Z, which is this generation of kids who grew up in the midst of the meltdown. Lots of their parents lost jobs. Lots of the kids who were at their school might have been talking about that. They're way more hardworking. They are way more worried. They are way more like my grandparents than just about any generation in between. So that's actually not a bad thing. Their expectations are lower, and their capacity for kind of taking it, their expectations are lower, and I think they're going to work hard to try and get somewhere. I think, though, what they're going to experience is they're going to experience, ultimately, a failure of our healthcare system. I mean, that's where this is all headed, really, right? When Canada runs out of money, we run out of our ability to fund a universal, fully equitable, the richest healthcare system in the world. So I think we're at a moment where it's either going to go really wrong, and that's when people are going to wise up, or this next generation is going to help us all come to our senses. But I also do think that where we're going economically and the failure of the public to kind of grasp that has been a failure of the media. And you know how this is. Newspapers and news organizations are starved for money, and reporters are younger, less experienced, have less time, and are covering way more issues much more shallowly. So I think that's a very big problem. And the work that Chris Reagan's doing over at McGill, for example, to helping to educate journalists is really important. And I think we need leadership. I think we need leaders. We haven't had a prime minister who's talked about the economy as a problem and as an issue that needs to be managed, and premiers in quite a long time. We really need to be having that discussion, and leadership really matters in that discussion.
Well, I think what we have is political leaders, we just had an election. Political leaders, every political leader talks about the economy in terms of redistributive policies, in terms of consumption policies. We will consume, we will take 2% of taxes here and 3% of taxes there, and we will put a chicken in your pot. And even when they talk about things, it seems to me, like affordability of housing, which is an issue that was perhaps invented in British Columbia, they talk about it only in terms of cost side, but not in terms of, well, your income has been stagnant for for many years. And you know, that's part of the problem, too. So what's with that? Why are we only talking about one side of the equation? Is that the political reward system?
No, it's not. I mean, what I'm pausing because I'm going to, I guess, answer a slightly different question. I'm going to recall the growth and power of interest groups. And I do it because there was a time, again in political parties, when people with different interests came together and they converged. And what happened with the power of interest groups, people interested in something that directly interests them, is that they then became less interested in others. They were very focused upon their own particular goals. And one of the features in the last election campaign was that there was really no attempt to engage others. As somebody who is a certified, longstanding progressive, I'm sick and tired of having progressives casting everyone else as curmudgeons. Now, that's just not the case. But we're looking through a very narrow lens. And part of it is those institutions that used to bring interests and people together are no longer doing it. So what can? And I think that the possibility of serious discussion of issues that that are obviously of importance to people can do that. Now, I agree absolutely that they have to be put in a language that can be understood. This isn't going to be won by the economists. This is going to be won by people who are able to take economic reality and put it in ordinary terms that get down into households. We have to draw people back to an interest in public life. The last election saw people either leaving, not voting, or in an alarming development, as you said, opting for a very extreme no-point alternative, and doing that in large numbers and in unexpected places. I was surprised at the responses in BC. Now, this isn't about the charisma of a guy who ran fourth in the boasts. This is about a real concern about the validity, the pertinence of public policy. And so we have to find ways in which the pertinence of public policy is restored. And it may be that a post-COVID period presents us with an opportunity, providing that opportunity is also matched by actual proposals upon which people might act, which is what this committee has been trying to do.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let me turn it over. We have an intervener, which was Senator Brent Cotter from Saskatchewan. And Brent is a former Deputy Minister of Intergovernmental Affairs in Saskatchewan. And he is down that way and has a question.
Thank you, Ed, and thank you, Mr. Clark and Ms. Clark, for really inspiring us and being here and helping us in thinking many of these things through. I wanted to borrow two or three of the remarks that you made, one that Mr. Manley made a little bit earlier, and in sort of maybe three themes, and try to weave them together. I think part of this report angled toward the question of whether there's the potential for cooperative federalism these days in ways that don't appear to be self-evident. Mr. Clark, you started there. And recognizing, Premier Clark, your observation about how decentralized a country we are and the authority that resides in provincial and territorial governments in economic and social terms. And picking up the point that Mr. Manley made, that there is a train that's coming faster than these trains tend to usually come in our direction, not just about geopolitics, but you know, jobs of the future, Indigenous reconciliation and economic development, climate change challenges that are all national challenges for us, the nature of the future of the Canadian economy, and whether we need a big crisis or a big opportunity combined with a more visionary leadership to make the kind of constructive entanglement of our respective jurisdictions pull in the same direction. And I guess the question is whether there's enough at stake right now that leaders will look beyond the kind of narrow perspectives of their immediate obligations in ways that happened around Charlottetown, that happened after the Second World War, that happened in pulling together Medicare, for example, which was a merger of federal and provincial jurisdictions to make a big national program come together. Even it is said that the prime minister and premiers have been meeting regularly through the pandemic, first minister's meetings virtually. Is that possible? Is this report too naive in thinking that this is a moment in time when that kind of constructive entanglement of jurisdictions pulling in the same direction can meaningfully assist us as a country?
You're going to need help. First of all, we don't want to count on crisis, on a deeper crisis, because crisis affects people disproportionately. It affects different, and it could lead to more despair and more radical behavior. There needs to be a simple reassertion of the respectability of government, that the government cares. And it's not necessarily put in dollar terms what we're going to do for you or what we're going to do necessarily for your cause, but that it's a serious government. We're serious about the idea of governance. I think that an agency that is worth looking at is some creative, constructive use of the first minister's conferences. I think they can be very productive. They can be divisive, of course, but they can be very productive. They have been on climate matters in several occasions. But I think we also have to look around at who's out, who could be brought in. Not who are the furious, but who are the dissatisfied, and about what are they dissatisfied, and how can they be brought in and show an interest in their cause. And I think that the political parties are slipping into a situation where they're all seen as being more interested in themselves than in the public they're appealing. So I don't think there's any magic here, but I think there may be some learning from some things that have worked in the past in terms of drawing the federation together. There's another dimension that is emerging now. I'm sorry to do this. I don't recall a time in Canada when racism has been as evident, when there has been as much focusing on particular groups as there is now with Canadians of Asian origin. I've seen that happen individually. I've never seen it happen as a phenomena in the country before. And it's very dangerous. It's very troubling to a lot of people like us who have an idea of the country. I say that simply because I think that there is a risk that new small C crises are going to creep up on us and are going to cut away at us now that we're weak, and so that we're relatively weak. So there has to be some attention to identifying and asserting the strengths of this quite fortunate country, including the nature of our federation, which has not simply been a mechanical instrument. There have been various premiers of various parties in various provinces through history who have come together to try to make real progress. And I think those are issues that we have to focus on. Now, I think that in fact, you're providing them some fodder with that. There are things around which people can agree in this report. But I think we are in more trouble than we should be as a country. And we're not showing very much evidence of ways in which we might address that problem.
On the point you made about, as British Columbia, this issue of anti-Asian racism is a very real thing. And I know that politicians do need to talk about, we need to talk about anti-racism, and we need to talk about ways encouraging people to be more welcoming. I can't think of any better way for governments to make the point about racism than it welcoming more immigrants. Yeah. Than the government saying, we need more immigrants coming to this country from all over the world. Let's welcome them. Let's make this our national project. And this Canada's been the home for people from all over the world. All of us come mm-hmm. from somewhere, unless we're of First Nations descent. So I think, just sort of on that point. Mm-hmm. But I do think in terms of, to your point, Senator, specifically, this idea that there could be a national body, as suggested in the report, that would be bringing everybody together on a regular basis, that would be a third party, that would be kind of political, because I don't think, no offense, Chris, but the academics can really do this on their own. We really do need people who have some political experience in their background, and force everybody to get in the room and really hash it, help set the agenda for what needs to be discussed, and then force everybody to discuss it. I was my first year as chairing the premiers was also the first year that we went to two premiers conferences a year. So I've been to a lot of them, and every year they got worse and they got harder to do. And they became more political. They became more about scoring points and what do I want? They became more selfish as the years went on. So it doesn't mean it wasn't a great institution at the beginning and it didn't work at the beginning. Mm. I think it's run its course. So these FedProv meetings really need a third party, a legitimate third party who's going to drive the agenda and bring them together.
You mentioned the Prosperity Council earlier that's mentioned in the report. Do you see that helping to serve that function?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think a Senate-led, I've had a mixed relationship with the institution of the Senate, as I said to Senator Harder earlier, but I do think that the role that the Senate plays best is as a home of second sober thought, and really forward planning, thinking about the problems, being able to set aside politics amongst a group of people who intimately understand politics, but nonetheless don't let it get in their way. I think that could be a third party along with, supported by some really important, some of the economic leaders in the country like Policy Forum or, you know, the Canada Industry Council, you name it. But making sure that that discussion is a fulsome discussion. Because I can't tell you how sick I am of having the discussion about getting rid of interprovincial trade barriers. Yeah. We dropped all the interprovincial trade barriers in British Columbia. We said, okay, we're just going to get naked here. And nobody else did, not even Saskatchewan. And we have had that discussion 1,000 times and it's not going anywhere. Provinces and the feds need a push.
Let me go to a couple of these other questions. I'm going to go in a minute also. I'll just give him a two-minute warning to Robert Asselin, who is online with a question, the Vice President of Senior Vice President Policy at the Business Council of Canada, because maybe business has part of that push. I don't know. The first question here, perhaps you've already answered, but I do want to give you the opportunity and the question of the opportunity. It's clear from the statistics we've seen that while there have been efforts made to include vulnerable and disadvantaged Canadians in developing prosperity, the results, particularly during the pandemic, have not been particularly good. Racialized Canadians and other disadvantaged Canadians suffered disproportionately during the pandemic. How do we make sure that doesn't happen again?
Childcare. I mean, I'm not a racialized Canadian, but I am a woman, and my people do earn, what, 20 to 30% less than your people, Ed? So I feel like childcare would be a really important way to make sure that, you know, some of us who are on the margins, who are less equitably treated by society, could get a leg up. So that would be one thing. And I think I would say for Indigenous communities, what I've heard them say, and I don't want to speak for them, what I've heard them say is they want a piece of the action economically. And my experience with that is that's really through resource development.
Okay, second question here is on populism. Is the rise of populism a huge factor in widening the polarity in society? So how is populism playing into this difficulty forging consensus?
Populism is mainly negative now. There are some countries in which populism is much more positive. There have been periods in time when it's much more positive. It's now more about anger than it is about vision, about exclusion, than it is about proposal. So the phenomenon alone is not going to be a solution. It well could be that the instinct that leads to populist movements could be encouraged to talk about real positive things. I agree absolutely about specific issues like childcare. I think people are tuning out. I think they just, they don't believe the institutions are addressing the issues that are of interest to them. And addressing that is going to be a major part of the challenge. Because we are fundamentally an optimistic country. We have been, in any event. And if we, and it has been one of our significant assets. But it isn't guaranteed. We're now becoming a more cantankerous country than we were. I want to step back, if I can, to the question of the contents of our population. For a long time, we called ourselves multicultural, and we were, but we didn't really recognize that multicultural meant there are going to be different perspectives on traditional issues. Different cultures yield that. And is that a threat? It needn't be. It can be a great richness, but it can only be a richness if we recognize that this is a reality, that these that the attitudes of multicultural groups, the Asians are the most important because in this regard, because for a long time, they caused no trouble. They were a part of our population, but people didn't really recognize them as that. And now they are emerging as victims. And they may, you know this better than I, they may also be emerging as people who feel themselves socially friendless. Who's going to come to their support? Well, I think we all agree that multiculturalism and immigration are great potential assets to us. But we sort of got them here, we plunked them down, we didn't think about what they mean, we didn't think about how we modify the way the rest of the country works. We have to open up our thinking. I mean, again, I don't want this all to be praise of the report here, but the report indicates an opening of thinking and a willingness to look at other alternatives. The question is, what is a vehicle to carry discussion of those other alternatives towards some practical purposes? And one of the risks is that to this stage, they've depended in Canada upon the government of Canada saying, okay, go ahead and do it. And it may be that there's an opportunity to turn that to the advantage of the Senate report now. But something like that has to be done. We're in a status quo that is gradually getting worse. The Canadian dream is gradually getting less attractive. And a lot of the authorities to which we turn are not responding in a way that attracts attention. On the contrary, people are staying away from the votes, from the elections, or are voting in exotic ways. So you've got something, the Senate has something to build on, but it's going to be a real question as to how practically that is done. And we'll all think about it, but I don't have an exact suggestion today.
I promised Robert I would go to him. So Robert, are you out there in virtual land somewhere?
Hi there. Can everyone hear me?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Great. Well, thank you both for your thoughts and for your service to Canada. My question is really about strategy and ambition. Mr. Clark, you spoke a lot about the vehicle to get there. But my question is, it seems to me Canada has been successful because we did what was hard and we had strategies to deal with our national unity, to deal with the United States, to deal with the world as a relative small population. And I think what is lacking, and this is more of a question than a comment, but I welcome your thoughts on it. What are you think the missing strategies and the missing ambitions going forward? What do we need to unite Canadians around undertakings that are ambitious, that will unite them around a cause? And it seems that what the Senate group has done here is very purposeful. It's around building long-term growth and resilience in the economy. So what are your thoughts about ambition, about strategies to get more ambitious, and about a sense of purpose and resolve and moonshots for Canadians?
Well, ambition has to be married to doability. There's lots of ambition and a lot of thoughts. The question is, how in a country like ours, structured as we are, do we actually get something like this this moving? Again, I come back to the potential that is held by this report. It could be something around which that could be built. We're moving forward quietly on various points. There's more attention now to Indigenous rights. But there is no sense of movement about it. And you're really talking about what can be done that can cause some sense of common cause and purpose in the country. I think the Senate as a national institution can play a role in that. But because at the end of the day, that kind of leadership is not going to come from some town hall in British Columbia or in Alberta. It's got to come from people with the authority to do something of that kind. And you, the Senate, has that kind of authority, has a kind of authority that is worth exercising. I wish I had a better answer than that, because I remember a time when I was a student, when there were a lot of national conferences that were going on all the time that were highly productive. You'd go and you'd sit down and people would talk about what kind of futures were available to us. They weren't complaint, and neither were they simply narrow. They weren't simply advancing the interests of the sponsors. And that appears not to be the case now. So I wish I could be more help on this. I guess one answer is take what you have that might work, and there's a report before the Senate, and see what you can do with it.
Senator, I would add to that. I would say I think Canada needs to reimagine itself as the most international country in the world. We are already one of the most multicultural places in the world, and we should be welcoming more immigrants into the country to build our economy and building a society around that, around an open, free society around immigration. We should be working hard to form new trade agreements around the world so that we can reach out that way to other countries. We should strengthen our place at the United Nations and our place on the world stage so that we are, you know, that we grow our respect. And we should be bringing people from around the world to strengthen our academic institutions so that we're producing the best thought in conversation with the best and the brightest from around the globe. Like, to me, that is the future of Canada. It is a truly international, multicultural country where people come from all over the world to make the best place on earth. And we reach out and we bring in order to do that. That, to me, is a great national project.
Well, I want to sum up for half a second what I think I've learned, and then thank you and turn it back to Senator Harder. I hear about a kind of a decline. You both talked about decline, but it's a very gradual decline. And maybe it's a decline that's people distracted in their own filter bubbles and social media. Maybe it's a decline that they kind of feel and makes them frustrated, but they don't really feel invested enough in getting angry about it in some ways. I wonder about that. Joe, you've referenced several times institutions of nation building, not just the official institutions, but people coming together in different institutions that probably are less vibrant today and fewer of those opportunities. And certainly a pandemic has made that even more so. And, you know, when, at the beginning when I asked you, was this fundamental or cyclical, I sort of think there are some fundamental, you know, Christy, you talked about the media and the media not having the same, you know, capabilities and muscle tone that it once had. But, you know, but there's another media system that exists next to it. And that media system perhaps divides people into tribes more than it unifies it. So I guess we really need to create counterbalances of institutions that are unifying out there and can get dialogue going again. I think, you know, that would be some of the message I take away from you. I don't know if that's
fair.
Well,
we've done it before. I mean, it's a, I'm always amazed. Even I was young at the time. But the then premier...
Apparently when you were young, though, you went to national conferences on the future of Canada.
I did. But the then premiers of Ontario and Quebec, when the federal government was unwilling to address constitutional issues, convened the...
Confederation for Tomorrow
conference, John Roberts and Danielle Johnson. And they got every premier to come, including, I was astounded, your then premier, W.A.C. Bennett, and indeed mine, Ernest Manning. But they came, they were productive, they thought about things, they gave an example of this as a country, they chided the federal government into acting more quickly on initiatives which the federal government naturally took the credit later on. But nonetheless, these things have happened in the country, and it may be that we're in a period of preoccupation before. It may be that leaders are not feeling their responsibility or their capacity. It may be that this is just a dip from which we'll rise. I wish I could be more confident about that. I agree absolutely that we have all the reasons for optimism in the world, indeed. And that's not just because the world is so bad. It is because we have so much capacity here. But we are not meeting it. We could gradually just drift into indifference. That's the risk of Canada. That's always been the risk of Canada. And what's interesting, and the spirit we have to try to discover again, is how there has been a response to that that might give us guidance now in these very different times as to what might be done.
Well, thank you both for those insights on the how. And thank you to the Senate, I guess, for the nudge and the vision that that I think the Clarks are telling us we need.
That was the Right Honourable Joe Clark, former Prime Minister of Canada, and the Honourable Christy Clark, former Premier of British Columbia, as we heard, no relation, Actually, they'd never met each other until we were on the floor of the Senate a week and a half ago. I hope that everybody enjoyed that and found it helpful in terms of figuring out how we can build consensus in this country around policy. So at this point in the podcast, we'd like to take a moment to highlight one or more of our members that has gone above and beyond the call of duty in terms of their ongoing contribution to a stronger and more resilient Canada. So on Friday, October 15th, six Canadian banks, BMO, CIBC, National Bank of Canada, RBC, Scotiabank, and TD, together announced their pledge to join the Net Zero Banking Alliance as part of a global industry-led initiative to accelerate and support efforts to address climate change, and this in the run-up to the COP26 in Glasgow that starts at the beginning of November. So we are PPF proud of our members, these banks, and particularly CIBC, RBC, and Scotiabank, with whom we're involved in energy work, for their commitment to a net zero future. Okay, that's a wrap. And thank you all for tuning in. Share this episode with a friend. Leave us a review on the podcast platform of your choice. We love to hear from you, and we love to make adjustments based on what you're thinking. I want to thank my colleagues at the Public Policy Forum who make this podcast happen. I'm Edward Greenspan, and this has been Policy Speaking.